This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hey, Place to Be Nation, welcome to the SummerSlam Rewind for SummerSlam 1992. We hope you've been enjoying the series. I have a lot of great guests, a lot of cool memories, and looking at some really unique shows. I am Justin Rosero, of course, a co-host of the Place to Be podcast, and you hear me on the Kevin Kelly Show, where I host that show too, along with my sidekick, Kevin Kelly. You can find me, of course, at placetobenation.com as well. Also joining me at placetobenation.com is one of my close friends, and that is the great Steve Willey. Steve, how are you?
Doing pretty well. Thanks for having me on the Rewind series. It's first on for this. I'm kind of excited.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. And, of course, you can find Steve each and every week at the website as well. He co-writes The High Spot with Glenn Butler. You can hear him on the main event. And also, along with us on the Place to Be podcast, our monthly Raw rewatches. He's on with us at of course, hopefully you enjoyed those. We're into early 1993 there, so a lot more fun on the way, Mr. Willey.
Yeah, we'll be going through the mullets.
Yes, lots of mullets.
And the polka dots and the neon quite a bit here.
Yes, and of course, speaking of mullets and neon, there are plenty on the show we're going to talk about tonight. So let's bring in our third man here in the booth, and of course you know him as one of the greats in the wrestling world. You can hear his podcast each every week at placetobenation.com. He's the true voice of Ring of Honor. He's been ECW World Champion, competed all around the world, the one, the only, my hero, Steve Corino. Steve, how are you tonight?
Oh, thank you very much. I was feeling a little down when you said, you know, the other Steve was like a real good friend of yours. I thought that was my intro, but you know, yeah, you redeemed yourself pretty quick.
You don't get that from McGinn. You just get a lot of grumbling from him.
Hell don't.
Yeah, you don't get that. So, all right. So, yes, we're here to talk SummerSlam 92. The three of us have rewatched the show. We took some notes, and it's a very interesting show. The first ever pay-per-view for the company that took place overseas. A very unique flavor. And did you guys, we'll start with you, Steve Corino. Did you like the unique flavor right off the bat? Did you get that feel with the interviews with the fans and the kids out front? And did you think it hurt the show at all to be pre-taped?
Oh, absolutely not. I'm not one of those guys that like believes that it's got to be, you know, 100% live. You know, if you're not there in the arena, anything you watch on TV is going to be okay. I absolutely love them interviewing fans and, you know, going showing American fans what England, you know, especially London is, and I thought it gave it a very unique flavor.
Willie, did you think it was the coolest looking pay-per-view in history to this point?
Well, just in terms of the crowd itself was pretty amazing. Seeing the foam green fingers everywhere, and it just looked like it went on forever. And Wembley Stadium is such a unique venue in general. If you've ever seen concerts from there, I think there was a Queen concert I remember seeing a long time ago on television that was from there. It's just an incredible facility.
It was. And how about the tape delay? Did you watch the show live as a kid?
No, I was 16 and I had no wrestling friends at that time, and my parents sure as heck weren't going to allow me to get pay-per-view. just for myself. So, no, I believe I saw this on videotape when it came out.
Yeah, this one I did watch live, and the pre-tape didn't bug me. We didn't really have too much access to a few days old. There was the old Providence Journal line that you could call and get wrestling and news results where they'd rip stuff off of Dave Meltzer and report it on there. But I don't know if I had been calling that yet. So I think I was pretty in the dark when the show aired. And it was, like I said, it was only a couple days later. So I did give them time to clean some stuff up. And they actually cut out a few matches that we can talk about at the end of the show here. So, all right. Steve Corino, opener. Legion of Doom versus Money Inc. Did you like the choice here for this one?
I love the choice. With my experience with booking, you really want to start a show off hot, especially a big show, and you want to get people talking. And, you know, and we're going to talk about the other matches on the show. But starting it off with Money Inc. and Legion of Doom, going back to their stories of, you know, trading the tag team titles a few times, I really thought it was going to give a oh wow feel to it. IRS and Ted DiBiase, very underrated as a tag team. You got two like amazing singles stars in there, and they were a great team. You know, imagine if they were in the NWA at the time, and they were just Ted DiBiase and Mike Rotundo, and just wrestlers. They would be hot, you know. But you know, they're in that character, and they worked it so well. Legion of Doom, no matter when they came out, always got that huge pop, even with all the backstage stuff that was going on with them. I thought it was a great choice for an opener.
Did you feel Rocco destroyed the credibility, Willie?
I don't know if destroyed is a strong word, but it definitely made them look kind of silly. Especially one thing I had noticed when Vince was calling them as they rode the motorcycles down, he was really portraying Rocco as the standout of the four, which yes. It's just, man, it felt like a slap in the face, and maybe it had to do something with what you were alluding to, Steve, that they, you know, there was issues in the back with them, that kind of a way to put them in their place. But I never understood the point of that.
Well, how many times did Heenan hit the word dummy in that match? Each time I like giggled a little bit inside.
Where does Rocco rank on your WrestleCrap ranking, Steve?
Oh, it's up there. You know, being a fan of wrestling, you know, since 1981, it just, you know, knowing the Road Warriors the way I did and watching them and, you know, going to the Philadelphia Civic Center every month when they were in the NWA, it really, I thought, hurt the mystique of the hardcore fan. But, you know, the little kid that didn't know any better, that just saw them as the Legion of Doom, I don't think it hurt them at all.
Did you guys feel like these should have been for the titles? Because Money Inc. had lost them over the summer to a team we'll talk about later. And it felt like this should have been the blow off to the tag title feud, because LOD had lost them to Money Inc. back in February. But as Corino mentioned there, LOD was about on their way out due to the backstage issue. So do you feel it was more important to have LOD win a non-title match than it would have been to put the titles up for grabs here?
Well, I thought...
Sorry. Go ahead, Willie. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I actually, when they first started, I thought that Money Inc. were the champions at that time. I wasn't paying attention the first couple minutes. So when LOD won, I was like, oh, they won the titles, and they'd never handed them over, and thought it was a non-title match at first, until later on in the show when we see the later tag team title match. So I was kind of surprised by that. It'd been a long time since I'd seen the show, so.
Yeah, same with me. Trying to remember back then who were the tag team champs. I couldn't remember if it was the Nasty Boys or Money Inc. But you know, I guess you would have wanted to see them as the tag team title match as opposed to what we got. Mm. But you know, I loved the whole structure of the match. And, you know, and DiBiase and IRS could just they could make anybody. And you know, with Hawk being messed up, and you know, an animal, you can read it in his book, you know, his mind wasn't there because he was pissed off at Hawk. You know, these guys, you know, DiBiase and IRS got like an amazing match out of
definitely. And do you guys feel, Willie, I'll start with you on this one, do you think this was Legion of Doom's last great match, or not even great, very good? We'll call it very good.
Well, it wasn't much. They didn't have much time left in WWF. When did they end up leaving?
Right after this, and then they had a run in WCW, like, what, 96? And then back 96. In the WWF in 97, 98-ish.
Yeah, nothing came to mind from WWF later on in the run. I know, you know, they had a little bit with the Godwins that was kind of fun, but not for poor Henry. yes, definitely not. WCW run was very forgettable. They did a lot of singles matches too, I think, in that little time on like Nitro.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Steve?
I agree. I think this was their last standout match. You know, especially in the American mainstream, they had a little bit of a reunion in Japan, but by that time, you know, when Animal went out with the injury and, you know, Hawk took Kensuke Sasaki as a partner, yeah. You know, I think it was the mystique was gone. And I think it's because they were mortal then. You know, they could lose every once in a while and they'd still be the Road Warriors. But when Animal went out with the injury and Hawk, you know, moved on with a new partner, it was like, oh, you know, the Beatles have broken up.
Right.
But so, yeah, this was, I think this was their last great showing together.
And it definitely felt like a big-time match. I think just when you're first soaking in the crowd in that opener, you almost overlook the match itself because I feel like you're taking in the crowd, you're taking in the atmosphere, and you're looking around, you hear the horns blowing, and it felt like a really big deal. And I think that was another reason why it was cool to have Legion of Doom there, because in the de facto rankings of in the Federation, they were pretty high as far as big-time names and stars go. So I thought it was a big deal to have them open up the show. So I thought that was a pretty good decision. So LOD win, they get a huge pop for the 80,000 plus here at Wembley, and an obvious finish, but a very good finish. And I thought it definitely was probably their last very good match. And as an opener, I don't think they could have picked anything better from this card. So any final thoughts on that match before we move on?
I like that the Ted DiBiase thinks the same way I do. Don't take the Doomsday device. Take a quick power slam for the finish.
Yes.
I was telling my wife, I said, I never took this from the Briscoes. And then DiBiase gets, you know, or Animal gets cut off real quick, and then they go to the power slam finish. So DiBiase is a smart man.
Yeah, he's like, and, screw that.
Yeah, I cringe every time. Even, you know, with the Briscoes, I was literally this afternoon, I was working out, and I had the Global Wars DVD on, and I think it was Jimmy Jacobs took the Doomsday device, and I was like, oh, he landed right on his rump. I was like, oh, thank goodness. Every time I see that move, I get worried.
Scary.
What happened to the good old heart attack? Let's just break that move back out, you know? It was a lot safer. All right, so we move ahead. We go backstage, Ric Flair doing a promo. So we have this great, really great show-long storyline that had been building for weeks and weeks, where what corner will Ric Flair and Mr. Perfect be in for the world title match? He had been teasing that one of the competitors had purchased their services. And to me, Flair hits the line of the night when Gene asks him finally, what dressing room are you going to be in? In the dressing room of the winner. And they just laugh and walk off. So I love that promo. I love this whole angle. Steve, what did you think of this heading in? Did you like it? Did you buy into it? Did it feel realistic to you?
It was good because, you know, you had the history with Savage and Ultimate Warrior, and then you have the troublemakers of Perfect and Flair. And I remember, you know, it clicked right back to me like, oh my goodness, I remember these guys trying to restart that rivalry and, you know, and them claiming that they're going to be in somebody's corner. I thought it was brilliant because you knew with wrestling, you got to have a good guy and a bad guy. It's so tough to do two good guys, especially with guys with a history. And Flair and Mr. Perfect not being in the match still had so much heat because you had somebody to hate and you could just enjoy the match. I thought the promo was perfect.
Pun intended.
Yes.
Okay. Willie?
Yeah, and it really showed and showcased Perfect and Flair as the smartest men in the company. You know, they are the master manipulators. They are the true, you know, I know Heenan's on, but they are the true brains of the organization. Mm-hmm. Just kind of maniacal in their thinking, and I just love that. Love watching that in heels.
Right, you knew something was up even at this point. I mean, you didn't really know, but you knew, and they were so cocky about it. And Gene was like the perfect foil in these kind of promos, so it was really...
I thought was great was that Heenan would, you know, because Vince would ask him what's going on, and he'd say, they didn't even tell me, you know.
Right, right.
So yeah. I love that little aspect, too.
Yeah, it was great. You had anything else there, Willie?
No.
Okay, so we move on to our second match, the most hyped match on the show, I thought, and that is Nails battling Virgil. Nails, of course, had just destroyed the Big Boss Man on Superstars, and his buddy Virgil coming to his defense. Willie, did you enjoy the Nails character in the storyline at all?
You know, again, I said I was around 16, and for you know, an older teenager, that he was a scary looking guy.
He was.
You usually would get scared as a little kid, but that guy, I mean, even still, like watching it back, like he is a frightening looking man.
I'll tell you what put it over was the WWF magazine had the pictures of the Boss Man after the beatdown, and he had the bruises and his eye was swollen shut and he was all beaten up, and that was what freaked me out the most. I was like, oh my god, this guy really got his ass kicked. Like, this is bad. And this animal is really pissed off. Why did they, you know, the biggest question to me, Carino, is, you know, as a fan of somewhat logistical wrestling and storyline, so why did they hire him? Why did they bring him in? Is it, were they forced by the state to give him a job? I mean, why did they let this guy wrestle?
Well, that's the thing is, you know, who signs a guy like this?
Yeah.
But, you know, being 1992 and I just turned 19. So, you know, I discovered the Wrestling Observer and the Pro Wrestling Torch, and I was privy to the, oh, that's Kevin Kelly from the AWA. And then I'm like, wow, he doesn't look the same. And man, he had a scary look and a scary way that he walked. And rewatching it, like, he walked like the Great Khali.
He does. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tripping over everything.
Yeah, like a bumbling fool. At least like Khali's 8'4" and has an excuse, but you know, nails
very
it.
Like Frankensteinish.
Oh, absolutely. And he had those big like Frankenstein like thick boots.
Yes, yeah.
But him beating up Virgil like just made me smile a little bit, because knowing Virgil the way I know Virgil on every convention or subway thing, you just go, man, where's nails when you need them?
What is it with the name Kevin Kelly and pasty white guys and thin blonde hair? I mean, it's they're almost like twins, these two guys.
Shoes.
They're almost like twins, the same lumbering. So Virgil, did he have any potential as a singles guy, or had he maxed it out when he won that $1 million belt from DiBiase and then kind of petered out from there? Was this his best usage of him, just kind of a name jobber to the stars guy?
I think so. I definitely think so. I thought when he had wrestled DiBiase for the $1 million belt, I thought, man, this guy's really good. And then I would watch him against everybody else, and I thought, wow, DiBiase is really, really good.
Really carried him there.
Yeah, and I wrestled I've wrestled Virgil a few times, and man, it's rough.
Do you think did you like the squash here, or did you think they should have accelerated the Boss Man feud to the show, or were you fine with them holding off on it?
I was very fine with the squash. I you know, I'm a big believer that sometimes you need a good squash to establish a killer character, and that was definitely one that needed it.
How about you, Willie? Did you think that the squash was good here, or would you have liked to see the Boss Man match at the show?
No, they needed to wait a little bit. They needed to build him up. They couldn't wait too long, seeing how you know, kind of awkward he was in the ring.
Right.
Nails that was.
And, how long? I was going to say, Willie, do you remember how long it was after this that him and Vince got into the fight?
No.
It was.
It's towards the end of 92, right?
Yeah, because that Survivor Series, and then they filmed the showdown with him and Undertaker. Well, first he was supposed to feud with Warrior, I think, on the house shows, because it was teased on a lot of house show cards. It was actually one I went to in November. It didn't happen because then Warrior left. But then he was supposed to fight the Undertaker. They had a pose down in the middle of the ring on Superstars. It was actually on the cover of a magazine, and that's when they fought, and that went nowhere. So I think that was the next Taker feud. So I don't know if all the Giant Gonzalez stuff happened because Nails left. If Nails would have gotten that Mania, like, I don't know how far it would have went with Taker and Nails, but I think it was the end of 92 when he got in the fight with Vince and choked him out and everything.
Mm. Smart move on his part, right?
Yeah, seriously, what do you have to be thinking?
And I think that was, I think it was it about his payout. It might have been about a Survivor Series payout. It was something along those lines with his pay. And then he popped up in WCW for like one match with Sting, and I think that was it. I don't think he ever did anything else. Really.
He was the convict, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Or the prisoner, or the convict. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Awful.
Very original name. Very original name. And he looked the same. He had the same jumpsuit and everything.
Yeah, and which was a dumber decision? You know, him choking up Vince McMahon, or then WCW hiring him right after that?
Yeah.
Right. Almost, what did they think? Like, this guy's gonna be the one. Hell with the NWO. We'll just book Nails.
So he was the prisoner for that one match, and then he went to Crockett's WWN as the convict.
Oh, my.
Then he went to New Japan, wrestled as Nails, worked in Tito Santana's AWF as Nails with an S, and then retired in 2000. So did you ever cross any paths with this guy, Steve?
Never.
Should bring him into the PWF there.
Oh, my goodness, right?
Let him work a few matches.
Yeah, hopefully he lives close and we'll take a payday off the door.
You could have him and Virgil in the rematch. I'm sure Virgil's available.
Holy shit. I don't even tell Virgil I run shows.
All right, let's head into our third match. This one had a pretty good build, and I really enjoyed this match, and that is Rick the Model Martel against Shawn Michaels. Michaels had just turned heel earlier in the year, so he's still kind of working his way up the card. And him and Martel have a stipulation in place here where neither guy could hit the other in the face because Sensational Sherry, who was Shawn Michaels' manager, thought they were both too handsome, and they didn't want to see anything happen to either man's face. Martel had been kind of just meandering around and just steps into this feud here. Did you like the storyline, Steve? Did you think it made sense? Was it an odd choice seeing Martel had been a heel and so was Shawn, and they're trying to kind of get Shawn over as a heel and they stick him in with a more hated heel? It seemed like a little bit of an odd decision.
See, I never bought the Rick Martel the Model character because I grew up, the first match I ever saw on television was Rick Martel and Tony Garea against Mr. Fuji and Mr. Saito. So, you know, Rick Martel to me was, you know, the blue and red trunks, and then he went to the AWA, and I was born in Canada, so like I would always, you know, correspond with my cousins up there, and we would talk AWA wrestling, and to me that was Rick Martel when he came back to the WWF and teamed with Zinc, and you know, and then eventually Santana. When he turned heel, I thought he'd be just more like Rick Martel, but like just turned up to heel. When he did the Model, I was like, no, that's not Rick Martel. And I was really hoping that this would be maybe the beginning of a babyface turn for him. And but it was definitely interesting to see how tight Shawn was as opposed to the real loose, you know, just show stealer from just a couple of years later.
Yeah,
he you could tell he's still trying to work out the kinks as being a heel and what he wanted to do instead of that guy that was like a rubber band. He could be everywhere. And but Sensational Sherry, though, she was awesome.
Oh,
and
so good in this.
Really, she could really sell everything, and I really enjoyed that.
What did you, Willie? I think you had a little hachi-machi going on with those that outfit she had on, huh?
Yeah, I think I texted you or something like that. She is such an enigma.
Yeah,
she's like, you know, on one hand garish, but you know, incredibly attractive on the other hand, and yeah, it's kind of a, you know, there. I don't think there's anyone really that's been like her in the history of wrestling.
And for those who haven't seen it, so she had these like chaps on that basically assless chaps, and then she had like a nylon tights or whatever under there, fishnets underneath, so her moon was out over Wembley Stadium for this match as she tried to impress both men. And Steve, now you've had some interaction obviously with Sherry, you mentioned a little bit there. Any other cool stories about her on the road or anything?
She was I worked on a bunch of shows with her, and she was so sweet, like in the locker room, and she would always make sure, like, and you know, these are the days when, you know, she could get a little messed up herself, but she always was looking out for the boys. But in the ring, man, she was all business. I remember once I was doing something with, I can't even remember the guy I was wrestling, but she was like a special referee, and she said, push me. I said, all right. So I gave her like a little shove, and she slapped me so hard that I think my like right knee buckled. And then afterwards, she was like sweet as pie. She's like, I didn't catch you too hard, honey, did I? I was like, no. Yeah, but what a just a sweet woman. I was pretty down when she passed away.
Yeah, and she, I remember my lasting memory of her now is at that Hall of Fame when she went in and how happy she seemed. I remember she gave a great speech and she was really just over the moon about it. She seemed so happy to be back, and she did that little spot with when Kurt Angle was spoofing all the stuff Shawn Michaels had did, and he sang Sexy Kurt and he had her on there with him. He threw her down to the mat like Shawn used to. It was just cool seeing her back.
Yeah, she was great.
It's too bad. Someone that could have been used a lot on all these reunion shows and
definitely
stuff.
So good in her character. Like, you really believed she was evil, and you know, hearing it, you know, this is the, I think the second time I've heard how, like, what a wonderful person she really actually was.
And a dedicated heel is a woman where it wasn't like, you know, you see women, some of the divas today, and you're like, oh, she's such a bitch. Like, she wasn't a bitch. She was, like, just mean, you know? Yeah. Like, she wasn't, like, snooty bitchy. She was just, like, a jerk, you know? Like, that's what – she was a real heel. That's what made it so great. And they always paired her with the right people. Like, Savage.
Oh, absolutely.
She was very fitting with Savage when they were doing the kind of the crazy tapped thing. And then she fit in with DiBiase doing kind of the rich man's, you know, sugar mama thing. And then she fit well as the MILF with Sean, one of the first MILFs in society, perhaps, before that word was popular. But she, you know, broke in the young guy there for a bit, too. So always fit well. Willie, do you think Martel could have gone face at this point? Or do you think he was so ingrained as the model to that generation coming up? Because it's funny that Steve mentions always knowing him as just a face Martel, because I started watching wrestling in 1990, had just turned heel. So I only knew him as the model for so long until I was able to go back and rewatch stuff. Do you think he could have had a little face run here?
Yeah, they were definitely kind of teasing it for a bit in the match that he could have been the face of this. Actually, I don't know if it was the match. Maybe it was the Superstars before that, where right. He was kind of, you know, kind of looking out to the crowd a little bit, trying to get some, you know, not really, but just trying to get some cheers. Mm-hmm. One other thing that I, you know, kind of noticed watching was like, well, you know, the AWA connections again here. You had mentioned Kevin Kelly before, Steve. You know, all three of these, you know, AWA stalwarts, and more of it comes during the show.
Yeah, it's kind of a cool thread you don't always think of, because you always think of like, oh, we're the NWO guys. I mean, NWA guys, WCW guys. You don't actually always think of the AWA thread through some of these shows. But and this is a weird one, because AWA have been gone for, you know, a couple of years now, so or at least a year and a half, but a couple of years from meaning anything. So it's kind of cool to see them featured here. On the surface, I thought the gimmick may hamstring the match a bit, but I thought it allowed for a good build and kind of similar to Martel's blindfold match with Jake Roberts at WrestleMania 7, where the crowd kind of gets into it. You're waiting to see who's going to be the first one to slug the other one in the face, and you get the whole Sherry play out on the outside and alternating between the two guys, and Sean slaps Martel first, he answers, and Sherry faints, and from there it kind of goes down the toilet with the kind of a weak finish, and they fight to the back, and Sean's carrying Sherry, then Martel's carrying her, and then they dump the water on her, and she's left just kind of sitting on the floor screaming. But I will say this, I thought the crowd was scorching hot for this whole thing. I thought they were super into this match. I thought it had a really, really cool build. And even though the last few minutes kind of fell apart, I thought it was really fun up until that point.
Totally agree.
So, like, I'm usually not the guy, and Justin knows, who, like, nitpicks matches at all. Like, I just tend to enjoy them for what they are. But the one thing that I kind of groaned at was right in the beginning of the match, I think it was Sean, like, it hits Martel right in the face with a drop kick. It was like, dude, you're not supposed to touch each other in the face. And nailed him, just like a perfect drop kick, just nailed him with it. It's usually that stuff doesn't get to me that much, but that one, for some reason, like, it's the whole point of the match.
It's probably one of those things where he took off and realized what he was doing in midair. Was right, like,
exactly.
Here we go.
Just habit.
But, hey, he throws such a perfect drop kick, you can't punish him for it. Did you guys feel like watching this match that Sean felt like a breakout star? Because I know you mentioned, Steve, that he felt still a little bit kind of unsure, uneasy in the ring. Could you see it there? Did you know? Did you think it was going to click at some point?
I definitely did. I definitely thought that they had huge plans for him as soon as they, you know, broke him away from Marty. I really did. And I'm glad they did. They did a great job. And, you know, he took the ball and ran with it, so definitely saw big things for him.
How about you, Willie?
Yeah, and you notice in this match too, he was getting some pretty decent sized pops from the crowd in England, which is, you know, he was, you know, a complete heel at that point, not playing to the card at all, and he was getting some cheers.
All right, so that match wraps up. They leave. Sherry left there wet, alone, but would still be with Sean for at least another few weeks before a new storyline took over with them, and his career would continue to advance. So we move on now, and we have our first title match of the evening. We had mentioned the tag titles earlier, and we have the Natural Disasters are the champions, and they are facing off with the Beverly Brothers. Jimmy Hart, the whole story here was in over his head a little bit. He had multiple teams under his watch that all wanted tag title shots. You had the Nasty Boys, you had Money Inc., and so all these teams he's trying to handle and juggle. And, of course, here we end up getting the Beverlys, who are with the Genius. Did you guys feel like they were legit challengers here? Did they feel like they had a chance, Steve? Did you think, walking into this, they could have walked out as champs?
Oh, absolutely not. I thought they had no chance. And, know, even watching it 22 years later, I'm like, man, the Beverly Brothers had no chance. And going once again, and we were talking about the AWA connection here, I was a Destruction Crew fan. I thought big things when they'd come to the WWF that, you know, this team's going to be something if they're pushed the right way. But instead, they were pushed as brothers instead of, you know, it just didn't work.
What do you think, Willie?
Well, they were, out of all the tag teams, and they had a lot of tag teams at this point, they were the last one in the totem pole, probably.
Would you compare them to the
Bushwhackers? Or?
No, they were higher than that, because they had just come in the fall of 91, so they hadn't even been here a year yet. And I thought over the summer they had an interesting enough feud with the LOD, where they kept calling them the Legion of Sissies, and they were doing instead of the spray paint, they would have like finger paint, and they would paint on the jobbers' faces and stuff. So they were positioned as a pretty legit team in the summer just through that feud, trying to act like they were tougher than Legion of Doom. That was kind of the tongue-in-cheek joke for them. But I didn't think they were that low here. Would they become that? You know, would they fall that low by 93? Yeah, probably. This is probably their peak. But I wouldn't put them on that level just yet.
I agree. I totally agree.
But I can't say they were the most legitimate of challengers. I mean, I don't think anyone probably bought them having a chance coming in. I remember rooting for them as a kid because I really liked them, and their theme music was fantastic. What did you guys think of the Disasters as champions over the summer here? Did you think it was a nice break from the heel domination of the tag titles? Did you almost feel like a thank you run to Earthquake, or did you think they were a pretty cool-looking tag team to be champions here, Willie?
The Disasters were a team I didn't really appreciate when I was younger. Mm-hmm. I think I appreciate them, well, more John Tenta. I appreciate more as I get older. So I think I enjoy them now more. They're kind of the quintessential fat man team, I guess.
How about you, Steve?
It's the same thing. I always appreciated John Tenta. You know, reading about him before he went to the WWF, you know, with the stuff that, you know, him being a sumo wrestler, sure. You know, it's just one of those things where, like, man, this guy had a legit background. I was at SummerSlam 90 as a fan when he wrestled Hogan.
Love that
match. So, I was a big fan of his, and I actually got to wrestle him in 2001 in England. And I was telling my wife earlier, she's not a wrestling fan, so she doesn't. She'll go, yeah, okay, that was cool. But basically, what happened was, you know, we were setting it up the night before, and it's a small building in England, and how the ring is lit from like two sides. So they said, oh, well, Earthquake will come out and, you know, you'll turn. And I was the NWA champion at the time. You guys will turn and you guys will have a face-off. I go, well, when will I know he's there? They're going to have music. They're like, no music. So here it comes. I beat my guy. I have the belt. And all of a sudden, I noticed that there's a shadow and it's dark. I went, holy crap, this guy's so huge. And I turn around. He had blocked the light. I said, oh, man. But I actually wrestled him as Golga too, so real nice man, definitely a nice man.
Yeah, and a guy like Willie said, you kind of grow an appreciation for going back and watching a lot of his stuff, just how good of a worker he was.
And, yes, absolutely.
And I like them here, Summer Champs, and you know they scream heel team when you see guys that big, but they were kind of cool as the friendly, happy go lucky guys that could beat the shit out of you and crush you by sitting on you champions. So it's like they almost had this happy go lucky demeanor, but they could be real mean about it when they had to be. And I thought they were fine to have a couple months here as champions throughout the summer before Money Inc. would win them back. I mentioned the Beverly Brothers theme music earlier, Steve. Where do you rank theirs all time now? Because there was some pretty fantastic music.
It was. It's not my top 10, but you know, listening to it again, I was super impressed.
How about you?
No Quebecers. No Quebecers.
No, definitely not No Quebecers.
But oh, yeah, right. I mean, that's the one that if I hear that, I'll sing it for a week.
What did you guys think of the Genius as a manager? Did you think Lanny Poffo transitioned fine from wrestling into that? And by this point, he's pretty much on his last legs. Was he a decent enough fit for the Beverlys?
You know, I never really got the Genius.
I like the poems. The poems are cute.
Yeah, the
but beyond that, like when he's outside the ring, you know, did he really even do anything in this match?
No.
Outside of the poem?
No, he never seemed to get too involved. When he was with Mr. Perfect, I feel like he used to get pretty involved. But after that, he seemed to check out a bit as a manager.
I wasn't a fan.
Do you guys think they should have blown off the separate feuds here instead? Done Natural Disasters Money Inc. for the titles and Legion of Doom Beverly, since that was the big summer feud all year long?
Hindsight being 2020, maybe, but I think I would have rather seen Money Inc. versus the Road Warriors than I would have seen the Road Warriors versus the Beverly Brothers. Mm.
How about you,
Will? Yeah, and I don't know if it would have gotten the crowd so into the card. You know, that first match was so incredibly hot. I don't know, the two matches that you listed would have done the same thing.
I feel like if they did do that, it would have had been like LOD destroying them, just like squashing them in like a minute and a half in the opener. I feel like if they did that match instead, that's how it should have gone.
Mm. I don't want a minute squash in the opener.
10 less dummy references by Heenan, too. Wouldn't have enough time to get them all in.
I thought the Beverlys deserved a better run overall, though. Like you said, Steve, they were great as a destruction crew in AWA. Very smooth team. They broke down the bigger guys and worked them over. And they actually dominated most of the match, which I was surprised. I thought it was a little bit better than you would have expected. And the crowd's still super hot here. I don't know if anything's going to kill them off. But
good English crowd.
Yeah, definitely. They were starved for a show like this, and they delivered once they got it. But yeah, definitely better than I expected it to be. I liked that the Beverlys get to control a lot, get the show off. They didn't just get crushed, and the Disasters leave as champions, but their reign would only last about another month or so. Any final thoughts on this one?
Yeah.
Like how he pulled off the Mojo Riley splash at the end.
Yes, that's right. Always a staple in the earthquake matches. So I did notice here a lot of fillers between matches, a lot of promos and different things. Did you feel that was a product of the tape show and the ability to use a lot of post-production here? Because it felt like more than most WWF pay-per-views, they had a lot of filler between things.
I thought that I like the filler to keep me interested in between. I don't, for a fan that goes to a pay-per-view live, there is a lot of dead time. And it can also be a lot of dead time on, you know, television. And with a show with 80,000 people and you want to keep it hot for the crowd that's watching at home, I definitely thought, you know, reviewing all the angles, I really thought they did a good job with that. I liked it all.
So in a way, Willie, do you feel maybe it was more streamlined because they were able to take their time, put in what they wanted in post-production and make sure it kind of flowed seamlessly?
Yeah, it did flow nicely. You didn't have like major cutbacks to the announcers or anything like that, kind of stalling for time as people exited the ring. And you remember how long that entrance ramp was, too. That had to take a long time to have people come down. So when they would cut back to matches, they usually would have at least one of the performers already in the ring,
right,
to kind of speed things up. And I think that, you know, as a viewer, that's kind of appreciated.
Definitely. It's something, again, they were easily able to cut out when they had to in post-production. All right, up next, we have the Battle of Demolition as Crush took on Repo Man. Repo Man, of course, formerly Smash from Demolition, and Crush had just debuted over the summer, re-debuted, previously part of Demolition as well. He had come back now as the neon-wearing, mullet-smiling, junkyard-living, coconut-crushing Crush. I thought this was a pretty good spot for him. Did you think it was kind of similar to Nails, where they were just putting him over a guy to establish him as a threat?
I thought so. I mean, you know, I thought it was strange knowing that they were both members of Demolition, that like there was no real, you know, awkward moment, you know, just for the fans that knew, you had to know, you know, even then you had to know that, you know, these guys were together once. But I thought it was a good way to get Crush over, and, you know, Barry, like, it showed his strength too, because Barry Darso was 280 pounds there bumping around for the huge, huge Crush. And I wrestled Crush at least, oh man, I bet you I did 5 TV jobs for him in so many different characters. It was, and he was just a giant of a man. And I don't think you guys would ever remember this, but in 1996, when Crush had come back, you know, he was gone for a while, and then he went through the legal trouble.
Yep.
You know, right. And then he came back, and they put him with Clarence Mason. And there was a kid in the crowd chanting jailbird at him, and he pulls the kid over and beats the crap out of him. That's me.
Really?
Huh. Yes.
That's pretty great. I do remember that. I remember it very vividly. Yep.
Yeah, that's me. And I ended up I wrestled him as Crush in a tag match. And of course they made no thing like, hey, I think this is the kid that he beat up 4 weeks ago. And then I got him as Nation of Domination Crush. I got him as DOA Crush, and he did a dark match once as they were looking to see maybe we could try Kona Crush again. Of course I was the guy, and he was a real nice guy, but I remember once, and I think I had met Matt Hardy maybe two times by this point, where he's going over the match with me. He goes, all right, kid, I'm going to let you duck a clothesline tonight. And I look at Matt Hardy, he looks at me, and I'm like, all right, thanks. That was my offense for the match. And even now, 17 years later, me and Matt will talk over something. And he'll be like, you know what? I think I'm going to give this kid a duck clothesline tonight.
That's good. That is, I'll have to go back and dig those matches up on the network if they ever put them up
there.
Shotgun
Saturday night, baby.
There you go. Was it one of the ones in the club, or was it just a regular shotgun?
There was a couple in the club. There's a great one with me, Freddie Joe Floyd, and Aldo Montoya. then there's one with me, Joey Abs, Champagne, and Mike Maverick, and an eight man. Oh, there's some good ones out there.
What was Willie? What was your favorite Crush incarnation?
I like Jailbird Crush. I thought that one was good with the shark tattoo on his head. Yeah, I enjoyed that one.
How about you, Willie?
You know, now that we're going back, you know, I think I would have said that originally, but now that we're going back and watching it, I get a chuckle out of Kona Crush just because the neon and the two toned.
Mullet
that we've been talking about with the flambé,
the mullet,
as they call it now.
Rough, wasn't it?
Oh yeah,
it's very flowing,
feathered at the bottom in a completely different color.
I think
people pay for that look now.
I think the best it was when he first turned on Savage, that few weeks when I feel like that's when he was really, really super over as a heel, when he wrecked Savage and was with Fuji. And also, and this leads to my next question about Crush's main event level potential. When he was going to slam Yokozuna on the Intrepid, he was the one that actually got him up the highest. He got him up and could have just dropped him, but he put him back down, and Luger ended up doing the kind of half-ass hip toss thing. But I thought they could have made Crush at that point. He was mired in the doink stuff, but if he comes out on the Intrepid, slams Yoko, I thought he could have been a pretty high-level player for them throughout 93.
I might have bought him more than I would have bought Luger.
Yeah.
And they could have kept Luger as a narcissist, where he was better suited. So I it was one of those little fantasy bookings out there that what Crush could have been in 1993. But my last Crush anecdotal story here. So I remember when he debuted, it was when they were doing four Raw tapings at once. And I remember he debuted on the last one of the cycle. And I felt like it buried him out of the gate, because that fourth Raw was always the most dead part of the crowd. I remember him coming out and nobody gave a shit. And I'm like, they killed this guy by having him in the last hour of this mega long Raw taping.
Mm.
But I never attended one of those, but I'm sure it was grueling to sit through. But
just go back to what we
were with Crush as the Jailbird. It was the 17th match of the night, and by that time I'm like, and if you watch it, I'm going hoarse, because I had to act like a fan for 17 matches. it was ridiculous.
How long were those shows?
Oh, they were 17. Ever. I mean, you were taping 4 weeks. I mean, they ran through them pretty quick, but they're basically just taping 4-minute matches. One guy's out and the next jobber's coming to the ring.
Yeah, they blew through them pretty quick, I'm sure. I don't think I ever went to though. I never went to even a Superstars one, I don't think. I mean, I know those were really, really long, where they would tape three episodes of Superstars, a match for All-American, a match for Saturday Night's Main Event. You know, they were just 30 matches on those cards. If you go back and look at a Graham site.
There were a couple of Ring of Honor shows back in the day, I think when Gabe was there, that were in Chicago. I remember one specifically. I think they had the Dragon Gate competitors there, and Joe was still there. It was an amazing card, but by the time you got in, was in like 6:30-ish or so, and we didn't get out of there until close to 1 in the morning. And those were just, they were so hard to go through because you were so burned out by halfway through because the matches were incredible. And
they're draining. Yeah, they're definitely draining.
I remember just like out in the bleachers, I remember, you know, fighting sleep by the main event, which I really wanted to see, but I was just so exhausted.
Yeah, it's a long night, especially when you're into a lot of the stuff. It can take a while, but all right. It was now time for the World Heavyweight Championship match. But before we get to that, why don't we pause really quickly? We'll take a short break. We'll hear from our sponsors. We'll come back. We'll tackle these last three matches. Two of them are very, very big ones to discuss. So for Steve and Steve, this is Justin. We'll be right back.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly from Ring of Honor Wrestling. Make sure you check out The Kevin Kelly Show each and every week. We'll be talking about wrestling in the past and wrestling today. Plus, be talking about all kinds of sports and pop culture, whatever's on your mind, too. We'll answer your questions each and every week. The Kevin Kelly Show, right here, placetobenation.com.
This is the king of old school, Steve Corino, and you've heard all the rumors, and it's true. The Steve Corino Show is here. We talk about wrestling. We talk about baseball, movies, television, anything you want to talk about. New guest every week. That's right, the Steve Corino Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
Hey, this is Bauer from The Bauer Show, sports and more. You can check out The Bauer Show podcast every Wednesday and Friday right here at placetobenation.com.
The Bauer Show.
Chad, do you hate it when commercials run and run?
What do you mean, Parv?
Oh, never mind.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play on placetobenation.com and find us on iTunes. We are the only WCW Supercard exclusive podcast.
Greetings, friends. Ben Morse from Place to Be Nation's Main Event here. Tired of other podcasts constantly stuck in the past? Every other week, we give you a roundtable discussion of what's happening in wrestling today. Place to Be Nation's Main Event. We're holding everybody else down.
Looking for something different in your pro wrestling podcast? Look no further than the Pro Wrestling Super Show. Join me, Stephen Graham, every week as I'm joined by a rotating door of guests as we discuss a single topic each show, ranging from ECW pay-per-view reviews, wrestler snapshots, top six lists, and anything else you can think of. That's the Pro Wrestling Super Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
So you got the script, yeah? You all got it?
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds terrible. The Titans of Wrestling... Oh, brilliant.
Sorry.
The Titans of Wrestling are...
Pete, I'm a lead analyst for the show and breakdown matches.
Kelly, lead historian. I'm a jobber lover. Are you?
Johnny and I drink.
And yes, me, Parv. We watch old school wrestling and love it.
Titans of Wrestling.
You know you want to hear it.
What's going on? This is the Godfather, Nate Milton, with an offer you cannot refuse. Each and every week you can join Marcus Vanderberg, Big Nasty Alfred Kunawa, and myself on the Kings of Sport podcast, available exclusively on placetobenation.com, your one-stop spot for the best in sports and pop culture.
Hey, sports fans, this is Dr. G for Extra Point, Place to Be Nation's traditional sports talk podcast. Every episode, Scott Criscullo and I talk everything from the Big Four leagues to all the hot sports news with exclusive guests and analysts. Email us your comments and questions at extrapoint@placetobenation.com. That's the Extra Point, exclusively on placetobenation.com.
Hey, sports fans, Cowboy here. Make sure you make your weekly stop by the Sports Lounge here on placetobenation.com, where the boys and I tackle all the hot topics in the world of sports. We go behind the numbers and provide in-depth expert analysis on Major League Baseball, MMA, NFL, and more. The seats fill up quick, so grab your favorite cigar, kick back, and join us in the Sports Lounge, only on placetobenation.com.
In Rhode Island, and look for great food and a fun atmosphere, we'll be sure to stop by Bonehead's Wing Bar, 131 Washington Street in West Warwick, with over 65 different wing sauces and dozens of sandwiches, burgers, and appetizers. In a fully stocked bar, Bonehead's has something for everyone. Boneheads also shows every WWE and UFC pay-per-view, features live music, weekly trivia, and much, much more. So, be sure to stop in, tell Matt and the crew that Place to Be Nation sent you, and become a Bonehead today.
Hey, this is Rob Naylor. Do you still enjoy pro wrestling? Believe it or not, I still do. So you better join myself and Will on the Google Wrestling Podcast, exclusively at placetobenation.com.
Shit, I wasn't ready. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening and shit. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening to guys talk about old school wrestling, follow me and Charles on Wrestling with the Past podcast on Place to Be Nation.
On Return the Mailman, we talk about life with great enthusiasm, which eventually leads to disillusionment. and inevitably, hopelessness. But don't worry, there's lots of laughs along the way. So check us out every week or month or whatever on Richer and the Mailman.
What's up, wrestling fans? This is Jeff Peck, and you can check out my wrestling podcast, The Still Real to Us Show, every Saturday right here at placetobenation.com. It is a wrestling podcast from a fan's perspective, and we're not doing it in our mom's basement. So check it out every Saturday right here at placetobenation.com.
It's still real to me, damn it!
Looking for new wrestling, sports, and pop culture voices? Head over to placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We have an extremely talented staff that covers comics, video games, and all facets of entertainment. Our sports coverage spans all the major professional and collegiate sports, including MMA. Our fresh takes on professional wrestling are some of the best on the internet. Also, be sure to check out our friends at thehistoryofwwe.com, prowrestlingonly.com, Scott Keith blog at rspwfaq.net, and piledriverwrestling.net.
All right, we are back here reviewing SummerSlam 1992. Myself, Justin Zero, Steve Willie, Steve Carino. We are about probably halfway through the show, not match-wise, but time-wise, because we have two really big matches left and then a third not so big, but we'll get to that one in a minute. So up first here, we have the Ultimate Warrior challenging Macho Man Randy Savage for the world title. Savage had won that belt at WrestleMania 8, had spent the summer just kind of bouncing around, fighting different guys like IRS and Shawn Michaels, and still kind of tangentially keeping his feud going with Ric Flair. And then as we got closer to SummerSlam, they announced this match, and that's when the build really kicked off. You had them both playing it straight, that they were buddies, and this was going to be a clean match down the middle. But in the background, you had Ric Flair and Mr. Perfect claiming that one of these men had paid off Mr. Perfect to be in his corner. When the match starts, neither man, Perfect or Flair, is out there. So we get a clean start between these two. And Steve, did this match surprise you when it was announced? It seemed very un-WWF-like to have a face-face title match on a show like this.
Especially when you have a British Bulldog, Bret the Hitman Hart, and a Shawn Michaels, Rick Martel, you know, on the bill. It was so un-WWF at the time. And the placement of this match really still boggles my mind because, and I get it, because you want British Bulldog and Bret Hart to main event, but you're going back to the Bruno days by putting that in the middle, putting your world championship match in the middle of the card. For me, the history between the Ultimate Warrior and Randy Savage was the story in this, and you know, them trying to get over the hump of, you know, they're not really friends, but they're competitors. They're both good guys, and then you got the strings being pulled with Mr. Perfect and Ric Flair. And I always believed, you know, this is 1992. It's going to be 2 years before I make my professional wrestling debut. So you know, I'm a smart mark, but I still, you know, there's times when you look at somebody and you just don't trust them. And for me, that guy was Randy Savage. I never believed that he was like a true babyface. You know, he was always his own guy. So, like, I even thought, like, oh, there's going to be something here where he's going to go with either Flair and Hennig, and you know, they're going to do a number, and it's going to be revenge against for taking him out of wrestling at WrestleMania 7. But this match really showed, and you know, I really didn't have an appreciation for the Ultimate Warrior until basically the speech at the Hall of Fame, and we all know how that all ended up. But you know, for me, even as a kid, the Warrior didn't look like he loved professional wrestling, and you know, that bothered me, you know, because I loved it, and I think that was the same problem a lot of people, you know, a lot of, you know, nerdy wrestling fans like myself had problems with Luger. You know, you really didn't feel the love as you know, as you knew Ric Flair loved it, and you knew Kurt Hennig loved it, you knew Randy Savage loved it, and you even knew Hulk Hogan loved it. So, but it was matches with Randy Savage that really showed that, you know, how good Savage was, of course, but you know, how decent the Warrior could be when he had the right opponent, and Savage was always the right opponent for him. And this one blew me away again, because there was false finishes, there was crazy bumps, there was a story told, and you know, the finish for a huge pay-per-view, I get it, but
nowadays you'd have people crying on Twitter.
I mean, Warrior was positioned as a monster early here, and Savage was really working hard to break him down, focused, and they had kind of a cool attack, like Savage's back and Warrior's neck were the focuses. And every blow, I thought, felt intense and big, and the crowd was hanging on every shot. And I thought the match was allowed to breathe for a while before the angle kicked in, which I liked. I'm glad they didn't have Flair and Perfect come out immediately. They kind of let them go for a while. Savage's pile driver on Warrior, to me, was the spot of the match. Just really crushed him with it. And I want to ask you this. I'll start with you, Willie, because it kind of piggybacks off what Steve was saying about the Warrior. Do you think he's one of the best big match wrestlers ever? Because a lot of his other matches are not very good. But all of his big matches always delivered.
Well, at this point, yes. I'd say, well, and again, the two were with Savage, the two really big ones.
Even his Hogan match, even his Rude matches. Like, anytime he had a big match and a big storyline, it seems like he always delivered it.
And the Hogan one was, you know, was incredibly impressive. But, you know, Rude and Savage are, you know, two of my all-time favorites to watch. So it always felt kind of more, you know, to me, more on their side that, you know, they were kind of the bigger opponents as anything else. But then, you know, the big matches that he had when he came back, you know, in WCW were some of the worst matches ever. So I would say that went away pretty much after this match. You know, we talked earlier on about LOD. You know, this is kind of their last big thing. But with Warrior too, this is, you know, not much more for him that really stood out.
Mm-hmm. True. What do you think, Steve?
He was a big when the lights were on and it was big time. I really believe that he did what he needed to do. We talk about the Hogan match. I loved it, and I was, once again, I was there at SummerSlam 90 with him and Rude in the cage, and you know it goes to show how good Hogan, Savage and Rude were, but you know, you need two to dance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think the Warrior, when he wanted to, was really good.
I think he worked well with Savage. I think the key too was a lot of the planning. You know, Savage, notorious pre, and see if he could probably speak better than we can, but a big pre-match planner guy, and legend always is that him and Hogan worked that match, you know, 30 times in Stanford before WrestleMania 6 or whatever. So it seems like when he really was able to lay out the match and set something up with a guy that could go is when he really shined.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, Ricky Steamboat said the same thing. It was, you know, he didn't consider Savage the greatest worker in the world because he couldn't just go out and do it. And, yeah, to me, it's a different business right now. You don't have to be the guy that calls it in the back or calls it in the ring. It's, you're just making emotion for all the fans. So that's I think the whole thing was whether he called a match 5 days before or 50 days before or called it in the ring, he still got to go out there and do it. And man, Savage was so good.
He was one of the best. Did you think the Flair and Perfect stuff ruined the flow of this match, Willie, or did it enhance it? So watching the match as it started to evolve, when they came out, did you feel like, oh, I was really into this, or did you think, okay, good, now we're getting started?
I thought it definitely brought the crowd down, and the crowd got very quiet, and I don't know if they were just quiet because, you know, they were ready for some sort of interference, or they were really, you know, quiet trying to figure out what are they going to do. One thing that I really enjoyed is watching this back was seeing how much fun Flair and Perfect were really having at ringside.
Mm-hmm.
Steve, you had mentioned before about, you know, guys, you know, who you can tell really love the business, and they were just having a blast out there doing their thing.
Oh, definitely. And you know, they look like two heels, you know, and you could tell that they just loved it, and the fans got into it. They bought all the false finishes.
Yep.
They even bought the finish, and I thought it was a good way to end the, you know, Savage Warrior rivalry with the Warrior carrying Savage, you know, to the back. I really liked it, and you know, I guess it was not long later that Flair won the title back, correct, on a TV taping?
It was actually 3 days later. So the finish was really well done because the whole thing was a setup, like you said, and it was really just to screw Savage over, and they beat the shit out of his ankle with a chair after the match, and then 3 days later, Flair beats him with the figure four to win the title. So it seemed like a screwy finish here, And it was. But it really, really paid off really beautifully. Like, the whole storyline is the whole time they were just fucking with both of them so they could bust up Savage's foot and then beat him with it 3 days later.
And that's the thing. And I think today's fans are always thinking, like, oh, I got to get a definitive finish. Whereas, you know, pro wrestling is the never-ending story. So while you're a little like, you didn't get a pinfall or submission, you're just a continuing of the story. And, you know, the next week, you know, Flair's the champion again because going back 3 days late, 3 days before, they had hurt his ankle. And, yeah, just, you know, brilliant. I really enjoyed this one.
Did you think Savage was struggling as champ, Willie, or is it just kind of a product of the doldrums of summer in a year like this before they had that summer pay-per-view to anchor things down? Because it was a long time between Mania and SummerSlam, and I feel like Savage had cooled off a bit and didn't really have much of a feud going on.
Yeah, this was an odd period for Savage. This year and the following year, too, in 93, you know, that we've been kind of watching back, where he is just... Yeah, I think part of the doldrums of summer, but I also just think this whole kind of run with him was a bit different than back before.
Because I
really go ahead.
No, I had watched a few years ago when that WWE had the online on demand and they had the Superstars from 92 up, and I remember watching them all. And Savage was like barely on. He would do an interview here and there, and he was like not on TV much at all. So it was really weird for them to have their champion just off like that. A guy like Savage, like a guy like Hogan was out filming movies or whatever, who was around working house shows and the European tours, but really didn't have much of anything going on until they announced this match. So it was a weird title run for him. Did you feel that
definitely
way, Steve?
Your title run for him? And I, you know, it just made me believe that, like, you know, was he supposed to get the titles and. Or was he supposed to get the title, or was there some sort of, you know, plan that didn't go well? You know, because I remember that was the time with, you know, we got the Sid and Flair and Hogan, and, you know, all of a sudden Savage ends up with the title. And, yeah, I really don't know if at that point him and Vince were so tight. I think, you know, he felt like, okay, you know, I can put it back on Savage for as long as I need it. And, you know, I just don't think he had a great story for it.
You're right, because the story leading up to the win was great, and it's almost like then they had nothing, because then his next thing is to lose it back to Flair pretty much. So he really felt like a pretty transitional champion, maybe just to draw in the houses over the summer, which is usually kind of a down period. Maybe that's why they wanted him with the belt instead of Flair. But, yeah, an odd run for him. I did think it was cool, though, to finally see these guys carrying a show outside of Hulk Hogan's shadow. This is really the first time they got a chance to do it together. Did you feel that, Steve? Did it feel different to you than in the past with these two guys?
No. I just thought it was for me. You know, Savage and Warrior just was such a good mix. So I don't think it missed Hogan. You know, if Hogan was in there, it would have been all right. I just think, you know, I don't think the whole pay per view missed Hogan. And you know, I might be wrong there, but to me, like, Hogan's time was – he needed a little time away in 1992, and I thought they had all the pieces together to keep it a great show.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Willie?
Oh, I didn't miss him at all. I was kind of done with him at that – you know, kind of out of the Hogan warship, as most kids were of that time, and ready to move on. Savage was – always more of one of my favorite guys to watch from the very get-go anyway. So it didn't really affect me. And then I thought, too, one thing I wrote down, well, you know, the WrestleMania match between the two guys, Savage and Warrior, had more of that emotional build with, you know, the retirement and all that. Flair and Perfect being there more than made up for it.
Well, that was going to be my next question, so we'll start with you, Willie. In general, overall match quality and package, where do you rank it versus WrestleMania 7?
I would rank it about equal. As I said, the emotional, the buy-in between the two during the first match was much greater. But having Flair and Perfect there, especially now, again, as I get older, and I really appreciate Flair a lot more than I did when I was a kid, because I just hated him as a kid. Just did not like him because, you know, he was doing his job is why I didn't like him. And it just made a smile on my face during the whole match when they were, like I said, going around ringside and whispering in each other's ear and just plotting. I'd actually kind of hoped that Flair would have wrestled on the card. He had his He had his gear on, and right. You know, I thought he was going to be in there at some point.
I always thought it was very weird that he didn't wrestle on this card, and we'll get to maybe a possibility for him later I wanted to bring up. But what did you think, Steve, this one compared to the retirement match at WrestleMania 7, even beyond the whole package and, like Steve said, the emotional piece? How about just even the quality of the match itself?
I thought the quality was great. I thought it was great. I mean, the retirement match was, you know, it had so much emotion. It wasn't for the title. It was the long feud. Savage cost him the WWF title at Royal Rumble against Slaughter. It, you know, there was all so much heat going into it. Whereas, you know, this one was for the title. It was, you know, it was a title match. At the end of the day, there were two guys going after the title. So it was a different story, same guys. And I thought the quality of the match was superb.
I liked this one a lot. I liked it almost in-ring wise, maybe a little bit better. Overall package, I'd probably still go with 7. But I thought this one was more hard-hitting and felt like more of a just kind of tossing heavy blows at each other. Like just really big. Every shot felt like it really meant something in this match. And it felt like, you know, WrestleMania 7 felt like two guys that had been embroiled in a blood feud. This felt like the two kings of the promotion, the two big heavyweights just going at it for the title. Like, it really felt like that to me with the crowd behind it. And it felt like the two top dogs. Hogan's gone. These are the two guys fighting for the belt now. These are the two kings of the WWF. And it really felt that way. It felt like we were trying to determine who was the new leader of the promotion that now that Hogan was finally gone. So,
and they both belong. They both belonged in that role, too. They both fit.
Right. Oh, definitely. Definitely. So, okay. Any final thoughts on this one?
Nope, I'm good.
Cool. No? All right. So, let's head on to our next match, which is a little bit different than the one we just talked about, and that is The Undertaker battling Kamala. Kamala had just debuted over the summer, along with Kim Chi and Harvey Whippleman, and gunning after The Undertaker here. They face off. Taker has an awesome entrance, of course. The highlight of the match probably when he comes out riding on the back of the English hearse with the did he have a no? He didn't have the vulture, right? That was WrestleMania 9. He just was riding on the back of the hearse, right?
Yes.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. With Paul Bearer walking very slow.
That's right. Okay. So the match itself, not that great. It's only about a few minutes. At least it's only a few minutes long though, so not too long. What did you guys think of Kamala? It was his time long gone. Did he really have a place at this point, or do you think he was fine as a heel foil for Taker, Steve?
I understood when Lawler found Kamala, what he needed to do and stuff like that. But for me, Kamala was in and out. You know, he couldn't stay too long. It's one quick feud and he had to go in my booking mind. I think he was... The character, because of, you know, how it was laid out, it is so slow and methodical, and he's, you know, if he hits the ropes, he's not a beast, and he always hit the ropes real weird, and to me, that you weren't going to get a great wrestling match out of it. By that time, I wanted to see the great wrestling match. I thought Taker did everything he could, but it was just it was the Divas match, you know, where they just throw it in between. Yes. And it's crazy to think that in 1992, they would throw Taker in that spot, you know, where it's like, oh, shit, we got, you know, Savage Warrior, and then we got Brett and Davey. Let's put Taker and Kamala right in between them. Ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this was the right place to put it, but it just, you know, Kamala is never the right opponent for somebody.
What do you think, Willie?
I was glad you went first on that one, Steve, because I was like, boy, I hope that Steve's not friends with him or something like that. I don't want to embarrass myself. Like I think of Kamala as a savage beast. Because that's like when I first started watching wrestling, like my first memories were of World Class Championship Wrestling and him and, you know, David Von Erich and, you know, the Freebirds kind of around that time. Those are my first memories of wrestling. And he's, you know, this savage beast at that point. And this is 10 years after that fact. And, you know, I had a friend, my friend Brett, who said he loved Kamala during his Memphis days. And the only Memphis stuff I have seen, unfortunately, is just the Jimmy Hart, Andy Kaufman, Jerry Lawler stuff. So I'd be interested if you guys had seen any of that and could, you know, kind of smarten me up to it. But you know, even against Undertaker, he doesn't look like a savage beast. You know,
he looks like Taker's a pussy.
And Taker's so big that he's, you know, he's what, 10 inches smaller than him?
But the booking made him look weak. Like, they just brought this guy in, and they have him scared of Taker, like, running away, and he's afraid of dying. And all. Like, he's supposed to be, he isn't supposed to know what death is. He's just a savage. He doesn't, you know, he's out there beating the shit out of guys. He's not supposed to run away from this guy already. And later on, they would do the casket thing where he's afraid of the cat. It seemed like they just ruined it right out of the gate with this guy. Whether or not you believed he had anything in the tank anyway, I thought he just looked really silly here, Steve. Did you agree?
I thought he looked totally silly. And, you know, at that time, the Undertaker character is still, you know, a year and a half old. You know, it could be come off as silly, and then you put him in there with a real silly gimmick. You have a chance of hurting this character that, you know, 22 years later, we still look upon as maybe the greatest character ever in professional wrestling. So, I mean, if you have a time machine, you're really taking quite the chance putting him with Kamala.
I mean, looking at this card, I'm trying to think of who else he even could have fought. I mean, I don't know where else I could have put him.
Yeah,
They were pretty thin.
Not just thin. I mean, they were high on tag teams or something like that, but, you know, with Taker as a babyface, you know, what heel, you know, was hot enough to work with him at the time?
Probably the only guy, and he was actually in a dark match. He defeated Tito Santana, and that was Papa Shango, who had all the stuff with the Warrior over the summer. And he was actually pushed pretty heavily on TV. If you watch a lot of those, like, Superstars throughout 92, he was really pushed as, like, a legitimate threat and someone to be scared of. So I'm a little bit surprised they didn't go that way instead, Taker and Shango.
Right, and them being such buddies outside the ring, you know, that's... you're right. I don't know why they didn't go that way.
And that brings me to my choice earlier from when I said someone for Ric Flair to fight. I thought him and Tito Santana could have been a cool match here. They actually fought in the SummerSlam Spectacular show, and I think they had a match overseas as well on one of the tours, but I think that could have been a really fun match to showcase Flair, get him ready for his angle later. Maybe you put that third or fourth from the top, and you let him go over Santana in, like, a really fun 10-minute match.
Yeah, I definitely, you know, especially for, like, old-school fans, I think that would have been great.
What do you think, Willie?
Oh yeah, totally agree with that. That's a good choice. I didn't realize that was a dark match at first, but yeah, Flair Santana would have been a lot of fun. And someone who we kind of enjoyed again on 93 watching, like, still really could go at that point, and still in really great shape. He looked really good.
I agree. Yeah, and Santana, I always believed, was so underrated.
Yeah.
Oh, very underrated. Someone I've gained a huge appreciation for. Just back when I had 24/7, watching a lot of those old house shows, and some of the wars he had with Greg Valentine on a house show were just incredible. I mean, they were like 4-star matches of them just beat the shit out of each other, and a real lot of fun. So the other dark match on this night, we should just go back and mention Jim Duggan and the Bushwhackers defeated the Mountie and the Nasty Boys. And there was actually one other match for the live crowd here, Steve. You mentioned, you know, Taker being in the diva spot between the two big matches, but Tatanka defeated Berserker in a singles match in between those as well. So that came after Taker on the live record, and then they cut it out when they aired it on pay-per-view. And,
I wasn't aware of that.
And here's a couple Mark anecdotes for you. So that match, all these matches, the dark matches, aired on primetime in the weeks later, and the lighting was dark for Tatanka Berserker, so that's how you knew it was recorded later. But they had advertised that match. And back at WrestleMania, they had advertised the British Bulldog facing Berserker. And I've always been a fan of, like, the kind of the goofier gimmicks when I was growing up, so I liked Berserker a lot. And I was so upset when they cut off these two matches that I wrote an angry letter to Stanford and Jack Tunney, complaining that they cut off, that they dropped two Berserker matches on these pay-per-views that I had ordered, and I really wanted to see them, and I couldn't understand why they did not show these matches that they had promised. I was very, very upset.
I wonder if you were the only one that did that.
I must have been. I'm sure I was. I think I also bitched about the title matches being in the middle of the show on both shows as well, that I felt like the championship should always close the show.
That's true anger. You know, you write it down, and then you have to go find the address, put it in the envelope. You have many opportunities to change your mind.
I mean, I'm assuming it was sent, and it wasn't just, like, shredded by my mom at work the next day when she got the letter. But as far as I know, it went out the door. So it was,
Jack Tunney writes back in your mom's handwriting.
You idiots. Oh, man. Okay, so it is now time for our main event, and that is Bret Hart defending his Intercontinental title against the British Bulldog. Obviously, due to the location here, why this is last, but it was pretty shocking to see the Intercontinental title main event a show, Willie. What did you think of that?
Oh, it was definitely different for really. Has there been any other show that has done this before? I couldn't really think of one offhand.
Not up till this point. I'm trying to think later on. Well, I guess Hogan Warrior technically, but that had the world title. I don't think that. I mean, to this point, there had never been an IC title match as the main event of a pay per view. No.
Right. So it was really different. And again, just like you said, I understand why they did it. You had 80,000 people. It's his hometown, but it still doesn't seem like the right choice. You know, looking back, maybe that was
really. So even watching that show again, you thought Warrior Savage should have went last instead of this?
I think you could have put that on like halfway through. Wow. You know, before they still did intermissions back then, right?
Yeah, they did.
You could have done that, had people go, and still had built it back up to, you know, if you're the one who wrote a letter to Jack Tunney.
No, I, at the time I was angry.
You're going to
question
me.
Looking back
now?
I am, because looking back at it, I don't know how you could not have Bulldog at the end with Lennox Lewis and the wife and the title and hugging him. I don't know how you can have that in the middle of the show. I mean, I just don't see it. The crowd was off the charts of this match and just out of their mind for Bulldog. I don't think you could have had it elsewhere. What do you think, Steve? Break the tie here.
It's a tough one. I'm a traditionalist with the – I think the world championship has to go last. But, I mean, circumstances the way they were, I just thought – I mean – even if the Intercontinental title is not on the line, but, you know, and here's my problem being the smart mark. Isn't Intercontinental meaning inside the continent?
Yes, yes, yes.
So I always had a problem with that, was the Intercontinental title switching hands anywhere that wasn't in, you know, the continent of North America. So I had that problem, I think Bret and Davey Boy just being a regular match would have just been just as huge. You know, it didn't have
you
to
think
be
so?
For the title.
You don't think him winning the gold at home in front of all those, like, it felt like a big deal that he was taking the title, though. Because Bret was positioned as such a great IC champion that I feel like that was one of the few times in company history when it almost felt almost world title level at this point. Like, Bret, to me, after that Piper win, had really been elevated, and that title felt really important. So it felt like a big deal that Bulldog won it.
Well, let me ask you this. Say they don't take the title off Flair at WrestleMania, and they go into Wembley with Flair Davey Boy as the world championship match. Do you think that would have been just as exciting or even more exciting than Bret and Davey Boy?
Oh, man. That's a tough one.
I would have loved that match.
Yeah, I think it would have been pretty awesome, but I will say this. Do you think, and I know this is going to sound a little blasphemous, do you think Flair could have gotten this match out of Bulldog? And I'm not saying Bret Hart's better than Ric Flair, but...
I think Bulldog was still good at that time. I liked him in 93, too, when he went to WCW. It was then, just after that I went, ah.
But I feel like it's kind of been proven, empirical evidence, that his best matches have always come with other Stampede Hart family guys, whether it's Owen, Bret, in tag versions, Dynamite. Like, I feel like those are always his best matches with those guys. So
they probably felt way, way more comfortable with those guys, too.
Right.
So.
I mean, these two had wrestled probably like 1,000 times before this match, you know, between Stampede shows and Dirty F. So I don't know if Bulldog, and I think Bulldog Flair would have had super heat and the crowd would have been batshit still for it. Yeah. I don't know if the match would have been as great, because I don't know if they had the chemistry that Bret and Bulldog had in the story with the family and all that added a little. And I feel like they played it up just enough. Like, they didn't overdo it, but it was there lingering, like these tensions that were there. It was the first time they had really done that with the Hart family. Obviously, it would happen, you know, dozens of times later, but I think this
was
really
the catalyst for that.
For everything.
Yeah. I really, you know, even 22 years later, I don't have a problem with it being the main event. But, you know, I think you could have went Flair or Davey Boy for the title, you know?
It would have been unique. Would you have done the Bret Shawn ladder match that was rumored that was supposed to be at the show if it was in Maryland?
I wouldn't mind it. Yeah, I wouldn't mind that at all. Or a Brett Perfect wasn't still working at the time.
So what do you do with Savage? Do you have Savage Warrior still fight?
I think you have Savage Warrior, you know, fighting, you know, out of pride or something like that. I'm not really sure. I mean, rebooking the whole thing is tough. It's definitely tough. But I mean, I had no problem with the whole card as a whole. I think it went really well, but you know, the Intercontinental title being last.
Do you think Davey Boy would have got a title run without the show being in England, Willie?
Ooh, in 1992, I don't know, because you know it was such a shock when Brett won it. You know, it was like finally won for the you know, I don't want to say the second tier guys, but really the second tier guys. You know, like he wasn't a main event. You know, and maybe this was the catalyst for him to get the title. Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh wow, he put on such a great match with Davey. Let's put the world title on him.
I don't think you're wrong with that. What do you think, Willie?
I don't think it was a shock that British Bulldog beat Hart at Wembley Stadium. I did think if you took it out, the Wembley Stadium part out, I did think it was kind of a shock for him to win the Intercontinental title. Just because he wasn't really, I mean, while he was great, and you know, Bulldogs are one of my favorite all-time tag teams from when I was younger, but I don't think he was really positioned as that level of, you know, like you said, Brett was, you know, more of, you know, the second tier at that time, but I don't think it was presented as Brett. It was, you know, it was a big upset.
Right.
You know, even mm-hmm. like the casual, you know, the casual fan, it was a big upset.
Yeah, Davey hadn't really been doing much of anything at all in 92. I mean, I think he had like a feud with Repo Man on TV through some of 92. So he really had nothing going on until this was announced. So I do think England was the main catalyst for him getting the gold. Do you think it was Davey Boy's best match ever?
I believe it was Davey's best singles match ever.
How about you, Willie?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. I always really liked. I think it was it on Raw that he had a European title match with Owen. I really liked that one too.
But, it was a great match.
But I think this one surpasses that.
All right, how about Steve? How about on Brett's pantheon? Where does it rank?
I mean, Brett had a lot of great matches, and I think this is one that like I remember the most about a singles match with him, but. You know what? I think, you know what? Like, I remember him. You know what? Thinking back, this is the match I remember Brett for.
Do you remember at all his one with Ed in Your House 5 they had in 1995 in Hershey where Brett bladed and was bleeding the buckets? Because I love that match too. And I always kind of compare the two in my head. And I think this one's better, but that one was really fun.
Now, was that the one right after Davey Boy turned heel, right?
Yeah, and Brett has bled a ton. It was really, really stiff, a lot stiffer than this match. Wasn't as like well orchestrated as this one, but it was more like a brawl.
Yeah, this one was good because it was sportsman. It was a great finish. I love the finish. You know, sometimes you know with a finish like that, there's a little bit of air left. Guy could kick out, but like. It really looked like Davey held the pin in there for the three.
I think he was so gassed that he just like collapsed on top of Brett. That's why he couldn't move. What do you think, Willie, on Brett's pantheon?
I'm biased because I was there, but it's easy to argue the match with Austin at WrestleMania.
I thought you were going to say you were in England.
I was like, oh, yeah, I was totally in England.
You're bringing it up now?
Me. Yeah, my parents wouldn't even get the pay-per-view for me, but they flew me out to London from Chicago. the match with Austin is always one of my – it's probably one of my all-time favorite matches. But this is definitely right up there with it.
Steve, do you think this is the moment Brett broke out on the stage and became like a true ring general? Because you could tell he's carrying Davey. Kind of has a quiet confidence throughout the match. Seems very confident what he's doing and every movement. You could tell he's leading the way through the match. Do you feel like this is like the real true first time? And like you said, it played into him then moving on to get the world title.
Yeah, maybe to the casual wrestling fan, but I remember seeing WrestleMania 2, the Battle Royal with, you know, and it ends up with the Hart Foundation and Andre. And you could just tell there that Brett is leading everybody around. He knows where to be. You know, he can cover up anything that Neidhart does. He can accentuate, you know, Andre's strength. That's where I really took notice that, man, this guy's the leader of this team. And then you watch him with the Bulldogs, and you knew that Dynamite and Brett were always going to lead, and they were going to do this. So, you know, for me as a wrestling fan, Bret Hart was always a leader. Being a singles competitor, I even thought, you know, when he would wrestle Perfect, you know, he would always be in the right spot at the right time.
What do you think, Willie?
Man, I totally blanked. I was listening to Steve. I totally blanked on the question there.
It was this Brett's kind of breakout moment as a ring general.
I'm thinking too. He had that match with Savage on Saturday Night's Main Event back in the day. It was he had a 1-on-1 match with Savage a few years before, didn't he?
Yeah, that was in on Saturday Night's Main Event. It was like what, 88?
Yeah, you can kind of tell there too, you know. And for me as a kid, kind of telling there too. And I wasn't really, you know, the smartest, you know, smartest guy watching wrestling at that point. I was just a complete casual fan. So I don't think that this one set him up as a ring general. It definitely set him up into just another atmosphere. Really, just put him up as one of the top guys around.
All right, final thought on this match: was it the greatest SummerSlam match ever? And is it the greatest Intercontinental title match ever, Steve?
Definitely not the greatest Intercontinental title match, in my opinion. That one still goes Steamboat Savage at WrestleMania 3. Greatest SummerSlam match ever? I don't know. I liked, you know, even though Perfect was hurt, I liked Bret and Perfect in SummerSlam 91. That to me is a favorite, and man, there's been so many good SummerSlams. For me personally, I loved Bret Perfect.
How about you, Willie?
Yeah, I like Bret Perfect. And then the tougher ones are the couple new ones that we've had. Is it 11 that, you know, the Lesnar match? And
yeah, I guess you'd have to say pre 2013 was it the best. The best SummerSlam match. It's probably been eclipsed by that match now.
Yeah, 2013. Man, the years are getting confused as I get older here. 2013, Lesnar and Punk had a match in there too. The Punk Lesnar match was the one I'm thinking of. I think that and Bret Perfect.
All right, so just some quick hits on the show in general. What did you guys think of Vince and Bobby on commentary? Did you enjoy them throughout, Steve?
I always enjoy Bobby. Vince is so over the top, you know, and I didn't mind it back then, but now you know, knowing the Mr. McMahon character and, you know, what he does, and then you watch it, and you watch the 1992 stuff now, he comes off really, really cheesy. But I enjoyed it. I thought that, you know, Vince, no matter what anybody says, will always show his ass to everybody. You know what I mean? Like, he won't... he'll let a heel get over on him or a baby face over on him for the good of the angle or the story and everything like that. And he always let, whether it be Ventura or, and then, you know, with Heenan and stuff like that, he always let, you know, them get their word on it. And so it was good. I liked them as a team. Yeah, no one was better in WWF though, in my opinion, than Gorilla and Bobby.
What do you think, Willie? Do you like this team here?
I love Bobby as well. I liked the thing was when it was Martel against HBK when Sherry faints and he goes, you know, I know when a woman faints, believe me. just cracks me up every time at any event that he's in. He's always good for a huge couple of laughs. You know, Vince at this time, you can cut and paste Vince from other events at this time and you really wouldn't be able to know what it was, what event it was coming from. Everything is very similar. He is a good foil for whoever, whatever heel commentator he's with, like you said, whether it's Jesse or Bobby. So he's not my favorite overall. Gorilla and Jesse or Gorilla and Bobby are my two favorite teams of that era by far.
I mean, I would disagree there that they were the best, but I'm such a Vince commentary mark. I love this whole run of his, but especially by 97, I think he's so good. Atmosphere and stadium. all time versus the really big shows. What did you guys think? Just the horns blowing, the crowd is nonstop greatness, the look of the arena. Did you guys feel like this is one of the greatest kind of presentations in pay-per-view history?
Oh, I definitely do, especially for 1992 and compared to what WCW was doing at the time. This was big time, and I thought it looked good. It stands the test of time, and an English crowd is always hot. Man, I've wrestled in England 15 different tours over the years, and it doesn't matter if it's a crowd of 100 people or, you know, 3,000. They're always super hot for professional wrestling. You know, they may overthink and write on the internet afterwards, but when they are in that building and they pay their hard-earned pounds, man, they are going to cheer and boo and leave that building, you know, tired from doing everything. So, it was a great choice. And Wembley Stadium, with all the history, American fans knew it from Live Aid. You know, that was only 7 years before. It was a total home run for the WWF at the time.
Willie, what was? Yep, go ahead.
I was going to say I love outdoor fans or outdoor shows as a fan. You know, the Cotton Bowl for Texas. You know, this one for Wembley Stadium. It's just such a different look, and when you can throw so many people in the stadium and have them be so excited, it just makes for just quite the show. And it's part of the show when you have such a hot crowd like that. It just makes everything feel that much more important, that much more iconic. And I kind of wonder, it was one note I had and one question I had for Steve, like, as a fan, I love those shows, but what's it like as a performer being in those outdoor type stadiums? Is it, you know, is it more difficult to wrestle, you know, based on the weather and the elements? Is, you know, how does it differ?
You know what, it all depends on the crowd, because you're going to get different acoustics in there as opposed to an arena or just a regular wrestling venue. If the crowd's hot, it's going to be hot. I've wrestled in Puerto Rico where we've had 300 people at a baseball stadium and it looks empty. Or, you know, I've been in outdoor things where it's so packed that, like, you're just feeding off, like, the energy in the sun. We would do the show in Japan at Yusukuni Shrine, which is an old sumo shrine in Tokyo, every year. And just the atmosphere, they had torches and they had dancing before, and there was a ceremony, and the crowd is just excited. It's during the cherry blossom festival, so, you know, it was my favorite show of the year, because, man, you would take a bump and you would look and there was torches. You felt like you were, you know, in like prehistoric times, and the crowd was always hot into it. So the crowd is always the number one important aspect of an outdoor show.
Steve, what was your match of the night here tonight?
Match of the night for me? That one's tough. You know, Brett and Davey Boy was amazing. It usually gets the praise. Warrior Savage was really good. I really, really enjoyed the opener. But I think match of the night, I'm going to go with Davey Boy and Brett.
Willie?
Same thing. I was surprised watching back how much I love Savage and Warrior, because as a kid, I just don't remember it standing out that much to me compared to the WrestleMania one. So it's a close second, and in any other show, it would probably be the match of the night. But, I mean, Bulldog and Brett is an all-time classic. So
yeah, I would agree.
Supplant that.
I would agree. Brett, Bulldog, and then Warrior Savage, a very, very close second. Steve, any disappointment on the night for you? Something you were looking forward to heading in and then ended up being kind of blah on?
No, definitely not. I mean, you know, we could always rebook it to make it be what we thought was going to be great. But, you know, even the matches that weren't impressive, you know, Nails and Virgil and Undertaker and Kamala, they all set the tone for the rest of the show. And, no disappointment at all. Definite double thumbs up for it.
Willie?
Love the show overall. In terms of any disappointments, like boy, I kind of would have liked to see those some of those dark matches that Tanahashi, Zerker, and Shango and Tito. You know, I could have, you know, replaced Nails and Virgil with that. Although, you know, I definitely understand why they put it on there. It was, there was a point to it. They were, you know, building up Nails and trying to just give him a little bit of a shine, so you can know where he was going against Boss Man.
I'll say Taker, Kamala. I would expect a little bit more, especially with that stupid finish. All right, you put the same exact card in a different atmosphere. Is it still a very good show? Is it a great show? What kind of changes, Steve, in your mind?
Definitely putting it in a different atmosphere is going to hurt it. And it depends on where you go. If you put it in New York, you're going to have to change the lineup. You're going to have to see, you know, Bretton, Davey Boy probably can't go first. Flair's got to wrestle. Savage Warrior definitely goes on top. I think it depends on where you put it. You're going to get some good atmosphere off it. For some reason, it was that day. It was hot in 1992 in England. They were hungry for wrestling. You know, this is a country that was really only exposed to World of Sport for so long. When the WWF came along, it like blew everybody out of the water. So putting it somewhere else, you're definitely going to get hurt, but by how much? You know, putting it in the Meadowlands wasn't going to hurt it. Putting it at Spectrum wasn't going to hurt it. Putting it, you know, in Dallas wasn't going to hurt it. I just think the right time, right place was London.
Willie?
Yeah, not much more to add there. The outside of the main event, which is, you know, you might not have seen if it was in the United States. You probably wouldn't have seen that happen. That would have probably been the big change. I think the crowd still would have eaten up LOD and Money Inc., even if it was inside, like, I don't even know, like the Carrier Dome or something in Syracuse. It probably would have, you know, still been a thing. It wouldn't have been that much of a change. It would still have been a hot show, but this just kind of took
I don't know if it would have been as I don't know if it would have been as hot though. I feel like it would have gone.
Definitely not.
I feel like it falls from like all time classic down to like a great memorable show. But I think you would have lost that extra something special that keeps it up high with the rankings in SummerSlam history. Like, I don't think you'd be talking about it as a top five show. I think you'd be saying, oh, it was a very good show, top 10. But I think that crowd and atmosphere just bumps it so much higher.
Oh, sure, definitely. We wouldn't be talking about it 20 years later in the same, as an all-time SummerSlam. It, at the time, in 92, it still would have been considered a very good show, but we wouldn't be talking about it now, probably.
All right, Steve, overall grade for the show, 1 to 5.
I'd give it a 4.5.
Very good. Mr. Willie?
It's a 4, 4.5, somewhere around there. Just a couple of the little singles matches, like you said, Undertaker, Kamala, Nails, Virgil, kind of brings it down a little bit, but you can't argue with two fantastic matches and one really great match with in the opener.
All right, I would agree there. So that will put this one in the books. Hope you guys have been enjoying this series and you enjoyed this installment. We have a few more to come, so be sure to check those out here on the Place to Be Network, and be sure to visit placementation.com. All throughout August, we have tons of SummerSlam coverage coming up for you leading into this year's show. All kinds of special sneaky little podcasts that we're going to sneak in for you to enjoy. So also, be sure to check out the Steve Corino Show each and every Friday morning at placementation.com. Steve always has some great guests, and he's going to carry his producer, which makes it extra hard for him. But he does a great job with that, too, and we love having him as part of the family here. You can check out Mr. Steve Willie on the Main Event every other Wednesday and occasionally on the Place to Be podcast as well. So for Steve Corino and Steve Willie, I am Justin Rosero. Enjoy SummerSlam season. We'll talk to you soon here at the Place to Be Nation.